What's going on, Meat Mafia? Welcome back to another episode of the Meat Mafia podcast. Before we get rolling here today, we want to give a quick shout out to you, the listener. We are so thankful to have you on board with the Meat Mafia, and we cannot thank you enough for your endless support. Without you guys, we are nothing. So thank you so much for your comments, feedback, likes, subscribes, listens, everything. It means the world to us. With that being said, please go to your podcast medium's platform, give us a 5-star review. If it's not 5 stars, maybe don't give us a review. Subscribe, do the whole thing. We really appreciate that. And also, please go check out some of the links below. We have some great sponsors and they are killing it in the world of food and providing great high quality food for people just like yourself. Quickly outlining our sponsors, we have Holy Cow Beef, Rick Ranch's, Equip Foods, and The Carnivore Bar. These are all great products. If you want to learn more, go check out the links below. Without further ado, here's a word from our sponsors. Holy Cow Beef is a regenerative farm based out of Lubbock, Texas, with humanely raised, grass-fed, grass-finished beef available for sale and shipment. Companies like ButcherBox source from outside of the US and Australia and don't specifically have the American Grass-Fed Association, or AGA, label, but Holy Cow does. They also sell chicken and pork in addition to their amazingly high-quality beef raised right here in Texas. Alden and Ann Warren have overcome their own health struggles, and they have inspired us by the way they live their lives and by the way they raise their animals. So go check them out in the link below, and they also accept Bitcoin, so all you Bitcoiners out there, go check out Holy Cow Beef. Also, if you're in Colorado, go check out Rick Ranch's, a grass-fed, grass-finished, regenerative farm servicing all over Colorado. He also accepts Bitcoin, so all you Bitcoiners out there, go hit up Rick Ranch's and get your beef today. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Carnivore Bar. The Carnivore Bar is an animal-based, shelf-stable product with only 3 simple ingredients: beef, tallow, and salt. The bar is inspired by the ancient traditions of Native Americans who needed to create pemmican bars to preserve meat for long-distance travel. The Carnivore Bar is perfect for animal-based athletes or busy people looking to follow a low-carb diet. It's easy to throw in a bag and take with you anywhere you're going, whether it's a workout, hike, or even packing it for a snack at work. I throw them in my triathlon bag and take down a bar immediately after working out. They're a fantastic product, so go check them out and use our discount code in the link below. All right, we're joined by healthy living and technology enthusiast Michael Coomer. So excited to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're excited. And we were saying before we hit the record button, we literally just bumped into each other at KetoCon. That's how we ended up meeting the first time. And that's how this podcast came together. But we realized that we have a lot of the same hobbies and same passions. And I know that similar to us, you have your own story of how you started to go on your nutritional journey from paleo, keto, carnivore. And I think that would be a great starting point is just to learn a little bit more about your story and how you got to the point where you're at now.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It actually started with just removing added sugars. We watched this documentary, I think it was called Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead or something like that, where that guy, I think, ate McDonald's for a month or something like that. And one of the segments, showed how much added sugars the average American consumes per year. And it was like bags and bags of sugar. And I'm like, this is nuts. We got to do something. And so my wife and I actually decided we're going to go through our pantry and just remove everything with added sugars. And after that exercise, the pantry was empty. I'm like, holy shit. Everything that we are buying, basically is added sugars. It's ridiculous. Even things that you wouldn't even expect, like a can of beans or something, had added sugar. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it makes sense because it, arguably, or for some people, tastes better. But that was really our entry into changing the way we ate and we lived. But funny enough, at that point, we weren't really unhealthy or anything. Well, I shouldn't say that because my wife actually was diagnosed with prediabetes at that point. And she had always had headaches and stuff and migraines. And after removing added sugar, suddenly all of that was gone. I'm like, hey, wow, there is evidently an impact or a correlation between what you eat and how you feel, right? And at the time, I was working out with a buddy in his basement, and he was always eating differently. Whenever we went out, to bucket or whatever, as we talked before, he would eat differently. And, you know, I'm like, what is it that you're doing? And he's like, well, he's on this, you know, paleolithic diet. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, if it works for you, good for you. And, but he never really pushed it or, you know, tried to explain what he is doing. You know, he would answer when asked, but that was about it. And at some point I, you know, kept asking him questions like, you know, can you eat this or can you eat that? You know, I'm sure you've gone through the same experience when you're on a different diet, people ask, mm-hmm. you know, can you eat that or, you know, and so I started asking him and I remember distinctively one day we were at Whole Foods and I'm like, you know, what about corn? And he's like, corn, that's the kryptonite of paleo. And I'm like, okay, no, not sure why, but, you know, okay, no corn then. Okay. Message received. And at some point, you know, I started doing more research and dug into what the paleo diet is. And I'm like, wow, this is how we should be eating. And so my wife and I, well, the entire family and even my mom and her husband from Austria came in and we visited DC for a, you know, quick vacation. And during that trip, I remember I woke up one morning and I told my wife, I said, starting tomorrow, I'm going to do paleo. And she's like, what do you mean you're doing paleo? I'm the one, you know, who's cooking. So if you do paleo, that means something is going to change for me and I'm not liking it. You know, I don't even know what paleo is. And so I didn't really approach it the right way. But, you know, at some point, you know, she did her own research and we decided, well, this is actually something, this is how we should be eating. And then I went to a conference and came back and said, you know what, then maybe 2 years later. And I came back and said, you know what, paleo, you know, it's okay, but keto is the thing that we got to do because carbs are bad. So we have to remove them from our diet and never eat them again. And she was again like, you know, dude, you know, I'm not going to just stop eating all the carbs. You know, we just learned how to prepare, you know, paleo meals and bake paleo and, you know, to make it work for the family and make it socially somewhat acceptable when we go somewhere. And now you come and say, we can't have half of the stuff we've been eating anymore. But what I should also mention, I think that also you made a similar experience there. I suffered from irritable bowel syndrome for most of my life. And yes. I noticed when we started paleo, and paleo, you know, means different things for different people. But for us in the beginning, it meant a piece of red meat and grilled zucchini. That was paleo for us. And all of my symptoms within a week were gone. I'm wow. like, whoa, you know, this is awesome. But the more we got into embracing paleo and modern paleo by making every meal paleo, by baking paleo, by using nut flours and all of the things that turned out to be not so good for us, my symptoms actually came back to a degree, not as bad as they used to be, but still, I would still feel bloated and, you know, uncomfortable and all of those things that come with IBS or any other gut disorder, I should say. And so I figured maybe keto would fix that again. But, you know, again, with modern keto, you know, you can make a lot of things keto. You know, you have the keto muffins and you know, your nut butters and all of those goodies to make keto really an awesome diet because, you know, you can have a lot of sweets that are not really, you know, with non-caloric sweeteners and with, you know, nut butters and all of the stuff that tastes really delicious. But it didn't really help my gut issues. I mean, I stuck it out for 3 years and I was pretty ripped at the time because, you know, no carbs and a lot of, you know, CrossFit. And I was metabolically, for the most part, very healthy based on just my blood workers and everything. But my gut issues were still there. And that really led me down the path to realizing that just because something is paleo, or just because something is keto, doesn't necessarily mean it's good for you. Or at least not in the amount that I was consuming certain foods, especially nut flours and nut-based products. And that led me down the path to an elimination diet and ultimately to the carnivore diet, because, you know, if you only eat red meat, chances are you'll feel awesome because there is nothing that could irritate you in any way. And so I did that and all my symptoms again were gone. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean I have to stick with only eating meat for the rest of my life, but there are certain foods that might not work for me, even if they might work for someone else. So I started embracing a more animal-based approach. That was around the time then also I met with Paul Saladino, and, you know, I realized that he was also transitioning more towards, you know, including more carbs, raw honey, seasonal fruits, some of the least toxic plants, you know, zucchini and squashes and all. And I tried that and I'm like, okay, this is really something that is not only working well for me, but it's also working incredibly well for the family because there is a lot of flexibility. You know, if you want to have more carbs one day, that's fine. If you want to do fasting and no carbs or low carbs another day, that works too. But you still stay within that dietary framework that removes pretty much everything that could be potentially irritating to your gut or cause any issues down the line. And so that's how we ended up where we are today on an animal-based diet with, you know, sometimes a paleolithic drift. Like, for example, we started fermenting sweet potatoes. Mm. And it turns out that if we ferment them, they have, you know, they are less glycemic. So they don't cause the same blood sugar spike as just regular sweet potatoes, especially if you, you know, remove the skin to get rid of some of the anti-nutrients. And so there are certain foods we still eat that are not traditionally animal-based or carnivore or meat-based, but that seem to be working well if prepared in, you know, appropriately. And so that's kind of our current framework. And I just noticed there's a lot of the sun is setting here.
You're glistening.
You're glistening.
Sun in my face, but yeah. So that's how we ended up from going, you know, from removing sugars, added sugars to paleo, keto, carnivore, and then ultimately an animal-based diet.
Did you find that mechanism of starting to cook more of your meals once you started getting onto the paleo diet to be a very effective way for you to really just start taking ownership of what you were doing with your health, even if it was a paleo diet, keto diet, vegan diet? I mean, if you're really starting to take control of the inputs, I feel like that does have like a very profound effect.
Yeah, but I should say we've always been preparing many of our meals, even on the standard American diet. You know, my wife was cooking or I was cooking. It, not necessarily the things, you know, we had like a lot of pasta and those kind of things that I grew up with in Austria. But it wasn't that we, you know, never prepared our own meals. Yes, we might have eaten out more or eaten more prepared foods or, you know, processed foods. I remember at some point we even, you know, had a freezer full of that lean cuisine kind of, you know, that you can pop in a microwave. Yes, we did that, but we also cooked a lot. But what I've definitely noticed, the more we learned about food and its impact, the more we started showing interest in finding out where the food comes from and how to prepare it appropriately so it's, you know, compatible with our physiology. That's definitely, you know, the case. And now even, you know, we have, you know, our own animals with a homestead here. Next year, we want to add, you know, meat rabbits and butcher them ourselves. And so it has really gotten, you know, to a point where, okay, it's not only important for me that I know the farm where the food comes from. I want to be the one, you know, processing that rabbit or the chicken or whatever the case might be. So I definitely know the entire life, I have control over the entire life cycle at the end of the day and can get the best food that I can, you know, feed my body and the family, of course.
Michael, what are the foods that you would say you base the pillars of your diet around that help you feel your best on a day-to-day basis?
Predominantly meat. Organs are an important part for us as well. But definitely, you know, meat from ruminant animals. We do eat some meat from monogastric animals as well. We have some, you know, white elk has some pasture chickens that are now fed a corn and soy-free diet. So we have those occasionally, and occasionally pork as well, but it's predominantly beef and bison. Or, you know, if we go hunting, or if, you know, buddies of ours, you know, hunt something, then they bring us some venison or something. But predominantly ruminant animals. So red meat.
Could you unpack that a little bit for our listeners, the difference between monogastric and a ruminant animal and what that actually means in terms of a nutritional benefits?
Yeah. So, you know, there are some animals like ruminants that are very proficient at turning grass into nutrients that are compatible with our physiology. And so, you know, with cows, they ferment, they, you know, spit it up again, they chew it again. They have a lot of ways of extracting nutrients that would otherwise be inaccessible, you know, for us or, you know, for the animal. And so that meat tends to be more nutritious and it tends to have a more beneficial fatty acid profile, especially as far as omega-6s and linoleic acid are concerned. And that's particularly true because it's relatively easy to feed a cow a species appropriate diet by just letting the cow eat grass, right? You know, if you eat grass fed, grass finished beef, then, you know, that animal had a natural diet. But with chickens and to a degree with pork and some other monogastric animals, you have to feed those animals. Like we have chickens in the backyard, and even though they're pasture-raised, they roam around the pasture and, you know, eat bugs and whatever they eat, and even some plants and, you know, legumes and all of that, we still need to feed them, extra feed, so to say. And most farms, you know, feed is expensive. I mean, you know, our corn and soy free organic feed makes the eggs that we eat so expensive that it's financially not worth it at all. We just do it because fortunately we can afford it and to eat the best eggs possible. But it's very difficult if we were a commercial farm to sell someone a dozen eggs for $15, you know, nobody would buy them. Mm-hmm. And so most of those animals, monogastric animals, including chicken, in particular chicken and also pork or pigs, they are fed a diet that's, you know, rich in corn and soy that are, you know, high in omega-6s. And too much omega-6 can be inflammatory, especially if your balance between omega-3 and omega-6 is out of whack. And that it is if the animal, you know, ate a lot of those grains and legumes that are high in omega-6. So if you eat pork or chicken, you get a lot of omega-6s in the meat that, and you might, and not enough omega-3. And so that's why we typically stick with ruminant meat from appropriately raised ruminants, because there the balance between omega-6 and omega-3 is how it should be, mm-hmm. in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's it's a really good answer. And I'm curious too, at what point in your nutritional journey did you and your wife decide that you wanted to get more intentional about sourcing your food and opting for more of the grass-fed, grass-finished product? And did you immediately start to notice a benefit when you did make that switch?
I know that, I mean, now looking back, just, you know, looking at, you know, my blood work, looking at, you know, my body fat and everything, I know that I am the healthiest and fittest that I've ever mm-hmm. been. And I'm 40 years old now. I used to be a professional sprinter in my early 20s, and I was pretty fit back then, but now I'm even fitter and definitely healthier. And so, no, I cannot really pinpoint an exact moment where suddenly, you know, things changed, but I took the time not too long ago where I picked out a picture from my early 20s when I was a sprinter, and, you know, and it was like without a shirt, then a picture from shortly after I arrived here in the United States. I think it was maybe around 2008, 2009, while I was on a standard American diet, where it looked like I was falling apart slowly, or, you know, started to fall apart. And then a picture from last year, and I put those three together. And I mean, you can see, you know, it was okay to not good to, you know, okay, this is where you want to be, you know, just from a, you know, what you can see, obviously, you know, a picture doesn't necessarily tell how you look like on the inside. But based on my blood work, and I've been keeping track of my blood work in an Excel spreadsheet since I started getting annuals, and all my blood markers, you know, especially triglycerides, and my HDL and my CRP and some of those other factors that I pay close attention to, and my insulin sensitivity or my fasting insulin have significantly improved over time. And so, not that I noticed, you know, I didn't wake up one day and say, okay, you know, now I suddenly I'm all different, but over time, gradually, you know, I have seen dramatic improvements.
How important is tracking some of these biomarkers for you? Because I know that's a big part of what you write about in terms of the technology component, like wearables and things like that. How important is that for you just to kind of like be aware of what's happening with your body?
You know, on the one hand, I like to think that you can only improve what you can measure, but I also realize that it's very easy to overdo all of those things. You know, if you keep track on every single thing and freak out if, you know, one morning your HRV is not where it should be, or your, you know, your Oura Ring or your Whoop tells you that you didn't have enough deep sleep, you know, if that starts stressing you out and giving you anxiety, then maybe it's time to back off a little bit and just listen to how you feel, you know, instead of keeping tabs on all of those things. At the same time, you know, I like to track certain things that give me an opportunity to kind of check in every so often and see, you know, the trend not necessarily, you know, a snapshot, but to see a trend line. Where am I going? You know, if is it beneficial for me to start, you know, including more carbohydrates? Does that perform, you know, help me perform better during workouts? What does that do to my, you know, fasting insulin? What does that do to my, you know, to my A1C or whatever the case might be? And as long as I, you know, don't see any negative impact, then I back off and, you know, let it be. But of course, you know, the more you know, the more you can correlate what you see in data with how you feel. I think that's really ultimately what matters most to me. So I can kind of confirm how I feel is actually, you know, what it is. Because sometimes, if, especially if you're in the beginning of your health journey, you know, that feedback you're getting from your body might not be an accurate reflection of what's going on. You know, if you're used to eat a standard American diet and your body tells you, oh, you need pizza, you know, that's maybe not a good signal that you want to follow, you know. But once you have reached a certain point, I believe that you're, where you're metabolically healthy, where your gut microbiome is where it should be, your body is typically very capable of telling you what you need and what you don't need, and how you're doing, you know. And so it's good to have those tools. It's, you know, use them wisely, but don't, you know, rely just on technology and just on gadgets to tell you how you feel, right? Mm-hmm. And I say that because I remember when my wife started, you know, with sleep and HRV tracking and all, you know, it gave her anxiety to see if she was in the red, or if she was, you know, everyone was in the green, but she was in the red. And, you know, and then another day in the red, and like, okay, what's going on? Something is going on. I'm like, yeah, if you didn't know that, you would be perfectly fine, you know? Right. So, you know, if you can use those tools wisely to improve and to, you know, make you feel better, go for it. If it gives you anxiety, then it may be just, you know, it's maybe time to take a step back, you know, take your shoes off, take your shirt off, go out in nature and just, you know, assess how you feel, you know, instead of using gadgets.
Mm. Are there any gadgets and wearables that you are very fond of that you incorporate throughout your day-to-day that you found to be effective for you?
I've had, and I've used many gadgets that I think are effective. I've been using Whoop for a while. I have the Oura Ring. I have a, you know, a smart mattress that's, you know, cools the mattress surface to a certain temperature and changes it throughout the night. And it also does some sleep and HRV tracking. So all of those tools I'm very fond of. I mean, on a daily basis, I think what I might rely most on is probably, or not, especially for sleeping, my mattress, because temperature for me, you know, is very important to have, to not be too hot, not be too cold, and to kind of support the body's natural changes in temperature, you know, through the different cycles of sleep. And that's been a real game changer, and that's something that I rely on every day to get my best possible sleep. But even, you know, other things like, you know, the Oura Ring or the Whoop strap, or, you know, what have you, they're all good. They're all, I enjoy them. But again, you know, it's not something that, if you don't have that, that doesn't mean you cannot be healthy and you cannot, you know, live a healthy and appropriate lifestyle. It just, you know, there are tools, nothing more that can help you. And once you know what you needed to know, you know, it's also okay if you go back to, you know, just assessing how you're feeling and not relying too much on gadgets.
Mm. You mentioned the sleep trackers, and it's something that I've messed around with. I've tried the Whoop. I have used the 8Sleep mattress, and sleep just in general and rest is a huge component of this whole health picture that I feel like honestly gets overlooked, even though it's like such a critical component of it all. How do you sort of articulate your thoughts around sleep and how important it is for your health?
We are very protective of our sleep. We are one of those guys, you know, even if we are, you know, somewhere invited or at a party, you know, we go home, you know, at a time where we would normally go to bed. I mean, there are some exceptions, but not even New Year, you know. Typically New Year for us means, you know, we celebrate, you know, via FaceTime with my family in Austria, which would be 6 p.m. here Eastern, you know, and after that, you know, we have dinner and we go to bed at a regular time.
Oh, that's so perfect.
Yeah, so we are weird, you know, or at least many people think so, but we are very protective of our sleep, because I know that if I don't sleep well, nothing else matters during the day. You know, I can't, you know, write the same quality, you know, content. I just don't work as efficiently as I would if I had, you know, an appropriate amount of quality sleep. And so we very much focus on that. But I should also say that, you know, what you do during the day is maybe as important as what you do before, you know, going to bed or when you go to bed. So we've noticed a significant improvement in sleep quality when we are expose ourselves to sunlight during the day. So, you know, getting the first rays of sunlight, you know, into your eyes, being out in the sun during, you know, midday, you know, exposing as much of your naked skin, you know, without sunscreen to the sun, you know, doing everything to support your circadian rhythm. You know, if that's working well, then you go to bed in the evening, you close your eyes, and within a couple of minutes, you sleep, and you sleep well. If you don't do that, I've noticed it during the biohacking conference when you're in, you know, in hotel rooms or, you know, in exhibition halls all day under artificial light, sleep is just not the same, you know. So sleep is very important. It's the foundation of everything, you know. Nothing else matters. I would never cut my sleep short to go working out, for example. You know, many people do that now, but that's like, you know, jumping over dollars to pick up pennies. You know, it's not worth it.
Yeah, I think Stan Efferding said that quote, and it's so true. And it's interesting how in Western society in particular, it's like that when you're busy or if you have things that pop up, it's like the first thing that you give up is sleep. Where I think the right. Three of us can attest, right? It's like the cognitive impairment that you feel when you're sleep deprived is insane. Whereas like when you get that really restful 8 hours, it's like you're so much more productive. But I still find myself fighting that too, where there's times where like, you know, I'm staying on my phone too long or I check my phone first thing in the morning. Whereas when you go out and get some natural sunlight, it just really sets your circadian rhythm and wakes you right up. So it's such a good
point. Yeah, no, absolutely. And many people believe, I think wrongly so, that they can get away with, you know, less than 7 hours of sleep. Yeah. And I've heard there's maybe 1% of the population that can actually do that. But based on, you know, how many people I see doing that, you know, it's significantly more than that 1% that think they can do it, but in reality can't. Most people just don't know, you know, how it feels to be full of energy, how to wake up in the morning and be ready to, you know, to tear it up and not be like, oh, I need my coffee first before I can even, you know, do anything. I mean, you know, I usually wake up and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to roll. You know, what are we going to do, you know? And most people don't have that.
Are you a coffee drinker?
I like the taste of coffee. I don't care for the caffeine, honestly. I don't need that to pick me up, but I just like the smell and the taste. And I think also the cultural component, I've noticed that. And it's the same with red wine. You know, if I'm somewhere and someone says, hey, you know, want to have a glass of red wine? I'm like, nah, not really. But if it's in that environment where I'm used to, you know, enjoying a glass of red wine with my wife, you know, I drink red wine. I mean, not, you know, I typically have a glass. And the same goes with coffee. I typically have, you know, I have a coffee at, you know, at 5:30 or so when I get up, and then maybe another cup and it's a watered down, you know, kind of, you know, coffee, not really. It's not a real coffee. Most people probably wouldn't like the taste, but yes, I have probably the equivalent of, I don't know, 70 milligrams of caffeine in the morning before 8 a.m. It's really the smell and the taste and the, you know, being in my office and having that cup of coffee next to me is just something that somehow triggers the pleasure centers of my brain.
Yeah. It's almost like you have a healthy relationship to it where you're doing it almost just for like the ritual component and you like the smell, and but you're not feeling pulled to have like two or three cups to, you know, write a blog or do work or things like that.
No. And there are many days where I don't have it and I'm perfectly fine. And actually I met a guy in Costa Rica at the animal-based gathering and he was like, coffee or caffeine is like the worst thing. And he, you know, and I bought the book that he recommended and I'm like, I gotta cut that out, you know, that's not good. It's gonna, you know, impair my sleep. And so I didn't drink coffee for a month. And I didn't really miss it. At least not, you know, there was nothing like, oh, I need to drink coffee. But nothing changed, you know, my sleep didn't change or improve. Nothing really changed. And I'm like, you know, so evidently whatever I was doing before didn't negatively impact me. So I went back to drinking decaf, but it just tastes like not so good. So I'm like, no, it's not the, So I went back to drinking a cup or two of coffee in the morning, and I sleep fine. Everything else is fine. So I'm like, evidently my body is capable of dealing with the, you know, the toxic nature of coffee. But of course, you know, we drink, you know, organic coffee and make sure it, you know, it's not full of pesticides and some of those other things that you get very often with traditional coffee or with conventionally grown coffee.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Michael, is maybe if you could touch on just how you think about like structuring your day to day for maximum productivity. And the reason why I'm saying that is like, if anyone goes to your blog, you have some of the most detailed articles on different pillars of nutrition, technology. We know you also run a supplement company, you're a father, like there's a lot of different things to balance there. And that's kind of something that we're going through right now is like, we're chasing the Meat Mafia full time. And there's a lot of different balls in the air. So I think it'd be pretty cool to learn just a little bit more about how you structure your day to get the most out of every 24 hours.
Yeah. I mean, it's work in progress. You know, it's, I change stuff up constantly to see how it works and what works and what doesn't. One thing that I've noticed is it's more about what you don't do that leads to success than what you do. And there are so many shiny things, you know, to chase after, so many products to review, so many products to test, so many things that I want to write about or could write about. But whenever I get to a point where I'm like, okay, there is way too much on my table. What is it really that A, brings me joy, and B, you know, can be monetized in a way so I can continue doing what I'm doing, you know? And by really taking a hard look at all of those things, you know, I start just cutting stuff out, and whatever doesn't bring me joy and whatever doesn't, you know, especially if it doesn't bring joy and no money, then, you know, I'm not going to do it just because someone wants to do me, you know, or wants me to do them a favor, or because, you know, whatever the reason might be. So it's all about, for me, productivity is all about the things that I don't do. Mm-hmm. And that's very often hard, you know, to make those cuts and to say, okay, I cannot do this right now, period. And that goes back to also, you know, working out. For a while, you know, for us, it was, you know, 6 times a week, we go to CrossFit, you know, that's, you know, set in stone, everything else has to come around, you know, our training. And at some point I realized, well, you know, CrossFit is set in stone, sauna bathing is set in stone, cold plunging is set in stone, walking the dog is set in stone. Obviously my, you know, work is set in stone. There are so many things now set in stone that I don't have enough, you know, hours in the day to do all the things that I set in stone. So I had to reevaluate. And I had to say, well, you know what, you know, on certain days, maybe, you know, that workout is not going to happen. You know, if I go for, you know, for a walk, then that has to be it. Or maybe I jump on my Caro bike and do an, you know, the 8-9 minute workout to at least, you know, dump some of my glycogen stores. And that has to be sufficient for the day. And if I cannot do the cold plunge every day, if I cannot do my sauna bathing every day, if I cannot do certain things every day, then that's okay. But that was a pretty tough lesson to learn and to figure out. But for me, it's like, you know, blocking off my working hours, my writing time, my recording time, and then everything around, I try to be flexible and just, you know, go with the flow. Because the more, the stricter you are, the more you try to hang on to a fixed schedule, the more stressed out you get, and the more you realize that, you know, you can't get everything done. And it's frustrating. And then at some point, you realize, well, you know, I'm not really enjoying what I'm doing anymore, even though it's my passion, just because I'm so stressed out all the time. So pick those things, like the things that are most joyful to you, the most that have the highest return on invest, be it emotional return on invest, be it financial return on invest, you know, whatever your priorities are, and everything else around, you know, you gotta drop stuff that are not happening, you know, be okay with it.
It's such a great point. I feel like there's such a balance between this order and chaos, or like structure and flexibility when it comes to managing the time. Like, you can get so structured that you end up just like almost like working yourself into the ground, or not having enough time to do all the things you want to do. Or you just like get in weird patterns where you're like thinking you're being productive, but you're, like you're saying, it's like, you know, you go to the gym 6 times a week. Could you be more efficient and just like get a more intense, like 3 or 4 really intense workouts, and then make do the other days? Like, there's ways to work around it. So it's cool to hear you say that. Good insight.
Yeah. Yeah, I know some people that do like micro scheduling that like block off, you know, every 15 minutes of what they want to do and all. But then you really, if you're behind one, you know, then suddenly everything has to shift and you're spend more time on changing your schedule than, you know, on doing actual work.
Mm.
And yeah, it's just, I think one of the, especially, you know, if you're like in a, you know, startup kind of environment where you, you know, start your own business, you want to do, you know, things that you've never done before, maybe. I think it's very important to carve out time where you don't do anything, where you can just, you know, go for a walk and reflect on what you're doing, what is working and what isn't. Because very often you're so down, you know, the rabbit hole and, you know, spinning that hamster wheel that you have no sense of direction of where, you know, the journey is going. And at some point, you know, you realize, oops, you know, I should have made changes a long time ago, and it might be too late at that point, or very difficult to make changes then, you know.
Yeah. What was the thought process for you? Because we know, like, as you've been building out this blog the last few years that you were working, I think it was a corporate sales job or a technology sales job.
Correct.
What was the thought process for you to end up leaving that job to pursue blogging and supplements full time?
I realized the technology, especially like enterprise, you know, I was in the SAP world. It's an enterprise resource, you know, planning kind of solution that large companies use to run their business. And I realized that SAP, or, you know, the software around it, is not really my passion, because I don't sit at home, you know, logging into SAP and, you know, creating purchase orders and, you know, doing all those things that, or changing, you know, managing authorizations, you know, that was really my niche. And so I'm like, okay, it's a fun job, you know, with nice people and all, but it's not really my passion. And I also, 5 years ago, I told my wife that, you know, when I turn 40, I'm going to do blogging full time. And it was more like a, you know, wishful kind of, you know, announcement that might not ever come true. But I reached a point financially also where the blog was making so much money in comparison to my day job that it was almost a no-brainer, you know, not to give up the day job and take the risk. And risk, obviously, you know, especially if you produce digital content and don't have a physical product, you know, and in my case in particular, I am at the mercy of Google. You know, whenever they make an algorithm change, suddenly people don't find my stuff anymore. It's not ranked on the first page anymore. And nobody comes, nobody, you know, no affiliate revenue, no, you know, display ad revenue whatsoever. So it was certainly a gamble. And it was also one of the reasons then why my wife, you know, really encouraged me to think about a physical product. And that's why we, you know, launched the organ meat supplements brand. But it was really at a point where, okay, this can sustain our family without me taking so much risk that if, you know, next month we might be broke and live on the street. And that was ultimately then the trigger why we said, you know what, let's do this and let's go for it.
What's the most, you mentioned, you know, do the things that bring you the most joy. What's the most joyful part about what you're doing now, fully into the whole entrepreneurial lifestyle right now?
I think it's still sharing what I've learned with others, be it, you know, through blog posts or, you know, YouTube videos or whatever the case might be, really sharing, you know, some of the information that I've learned and seeing others apply it and get benefits out of it. That's really, you know, if I get, you know, emails or, you know, comments or messages from people and say, hey, you know, I tried this and, you know, I feel so much better now. I'm full of energy and, you know, all of those things that was brings me joy. And that's, you know, ultimately the driver why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's really cool. To see that you have an impact on someone, you know, not only on your, obviously on your family, there is always an impact on your friends. There is an impact. But if you see strain, if you have an impact on someone you don't even know, you know, and they come back to you and say, hey, you know, thank you so much for, you know, putting out that article or, you know, recording this video or for, you know, your supplement at the end of the day.
Right.
It has helped me, you know, overcome whatever. I'm like, you know, good for you, buddy. You know, I'm glad I did. And, you know, that's what keeps me going.
Are you ever surprised by like information that you've come across that maybe you just maybe take for granted? And then you put it out there and it's like break someone's paradigm and they're like, oh my gosh, this is what I needed to figure out the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the best example is, you know, don't eat plants, you know, or at least be very selective, you know, with eating plants. That's, I mean, with much of what we do and, you know, you guys as well, it's kind of the exact opposite of what, you know, most doctors would tell you, you know, the government would tell you, and everyone thinks, you know, that's how we should live, you know, put on sunscreen, you know, first thing in the morning before you go out, because otherwise you're going to get, you know, cancer, skin cancer, you know, eat your veggies, you know, reduce your meat intake, use heart healthy, you know, vegetable oils, and stay away from butter and from saturated fats. And, you know, all of those things where you're like, duh, you know, I mean, yes, there is a lot of confusing and conflicting information out there, but this is so, you know, fundamental stuff that you should really learn about those things and educate yourself to find out what is true and what isn't. And, you know, when I then tell someone, you know, I don't eat any or barely any veggies, they're like, you're kidding me, right? Where do you get your nutrients from? And I'm like, not from veggies, you know, and yeah, it happens all the time. And it's, and that's why it's so difficult at times, you know, to put out information, because you assume, you know, a certain level of expert or knowledge, you know, among the population. But most people, they are so far removed from where, you know, we are right now. And I mean, you guys have gone, you know, have had a journey, you know, that probably didn't, none of what you know today happened overnight. You know, I know it's taken me a decade, you know, to get to where I am. And it's sometimes easy to forget that, you know, if you would have told me 10 years ago, you know, stop eating veggies and eat only meat, I would have told you, you know, you're an idiot, you know?
Yeah.
But now I see from an entirely different perspective. And it's very difficult sometimes to appreciate that not everyone is at the same level, and that it takes people time to figure those things out. And it's just very painful sometimes, because I'm like, you know, you don't have to waste 10 years, you know, and risk your health, you know, to get to where I am. You know, just take the shortcuts, you know, listen to what I have to say, do your own research, don't believe everything I say, but, you know, use it as an opportunity to do your own research, and then don't take 10 years, you know, to get to where I am. I mean, you can do it much quicker, you know, and mm-hmm. be healthier quicker than.
Yeah. It's an important reminder, because I think there's this natural thing to like almost take your own knowledge and what you know for granted. But I think to your point, it's like we're combating decades upon decades of misinformation around nutrition and how you should be properly taking care of yourself. I've told Harry this story before. When I first went carnivore in 2019, I was working a tech sales job in New York City. And, you know, some people that worked at the company, engineers, some of the most brilliant people you'll ever meet, degrees from MIT, Harvard, these incredible schools, and literally had no idea how to eat. Like, they were bringing Mountain Dews into the office and drinking Cokes and getting pizza and going out to happy hours. And I remember when I first went carnivore, I would bring very basic dishes into the office for lunch. So like a pound of ground beef or a ribeye chopped up. And they would come up to me and be like, dude, you're literally going to kill yourself eating that. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, I feel the best that I've ever felt.
Right.
My GI symptoms are getting better. I'm doing marathons. And not to sound like an asshole, but I'm like, you're 50 pounds overweight and you're trying to tell me what I should be eating.
Right.
And I'm not saying that they're doing anything wrong. I'm just saying that like, that's the paradigm of what they've been taught about nutrition. Right. And these are some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. Just, you know, I've noticed the same. There are so many smart people out there that, you know, just, I don't know why they don't get it or don't want to get it. But it's something that I can't quite reconcile, you know, yet. Mm. I don't know why that is. Why are there, you know, doctors and PhDs that, you know, say you should be, you know, stay away from meat and eat more plants? I can't reconcile that. You know, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, it is what it is. At the end of the day, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You know, let's all compare when we are 50 or 60 years old, and let's see who is doing better. You know, I feel pretty confident that I'm going to be on the winning side.
But you hit on a really good point, which is like there's so much distance between the two, like, you know, two schools of thought around animal-based and plant-based that like that you almost can't even really start to have like these conversations.
Yeah.
Which I think ends up being a huge disservice to the average person who just wants to like figure out something that's going to work better for them. Like, they're not looking, most people aren't looking for like close to perfect, like us three are, but they just want a little bit better and then maybe a little bit better a month from now. So, you know, I think it is kind of a disservice to people who are just looking for some like easy, simple, digestible information.
I was wondering, and I've asked it a lot of people, you know, what do you think is that good or bad overall for, you know, for our society that there is such a gap? I mean, I certainly believe that, you know, there needs to be opposition to anything, because otherwise we're not going to progress. We're not going to find out, you know, what is really working and what isn't, if nobody, you know, disagrees and goes in a completely an opposite direction. So it's just painful to see when you're on one end of the spectrum and you firmly believe that what you're doing is right. But, you know, I always say there's been a very long running study, you know, in terms of what humans should be eating, and that is evolution, you know. And so does it mean you can never have any plans or you shouldn't have any plans? No, I don't think so. I think many people are very capable of consuming, you know, an omnivore type of diet. I still think that if you want to have optimal health, if you want to really thrive and kick ass, then you're probably better off on the meat leaning side and being very careful what type of plants you include in your diet. If you can handle them, by all means, you know, eat them. If you're fine with tomatoes, eat your tomatoes. You know, I've gotten pretty relaxed in that regard, because I really am like, okay, I'm going to try this. If it sits well with me, I'm going to have it. You know, I'm okay with that. If I don't, then I don't. But one thing I've noticed, I've never had any issues, and I don't know anyone having ever had any issues, metabolically or otherwise, by eating only meat. You know, I've also not met anyone yet who started a carnivore diet and then had to stop because of health issues. There are plenty of vegans, though, that go on a drought and then have to come back because they've ruined their health. You know, so there are certain indications that maybe leaning towards the meat side is probably going to be better for you. Doesn't mean you have to exclude everything else, but be careful, you know, what you eat that is not based on responsibly raised, you know, animals. That's just, you know, the decision has been made many, many, you know, millions of years ago, when the plant eaters died off, you know, in the evolutionary branch, and the meat eaters continued and started thriving. And I had a very interesting conversation with Dr. Bill Schindler the other day, and he said one of the biggest milestones, and I think he was on your show as well, no, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
One of the most important milestones in human evolution was when we transitioned from scavenging to hunting, because we now suddenly had first access to all the meats and the fats and the most nutritious parts of the animal. And suddenly our, you know, brain started growing. You know, we started growing as, you know, in statue and all. And I mean, that in itself is a major indicator of what is most compatible with our physiology, you know? And so, but then again, you know, everyone should try whatever they want to and figure it out. You know, if you're thriving on vegan, and just by, I've yet to see a vegan who looks healthy and, you know, like a human should look like. But if that's what you're going for, you know, we live in a mostly free country, you know, go for it. Just don't do it to your kids or to your pets, to your carnivorous
oh, man.
Pets, you know.
Someone was trying to irritate me the other day, and they sent me an article that was like a dog walking around with a piece of lettuce in its mouth, and it was saying, like, you know, feed your dog a vegan diet, do what's right. And I was like, oh no, like, yeah, that dog is gonna be, yeah, like, yeah, miserable.
I mean, you know, I can have discussions about, you know, human diet, but when it comes to, you know, carnivores, you know, if you look at certain, you know, cats and dogs, you know, if you tell me that they're, you know, plant eaters, then you're hallucinating, or, you know, delusional, or what have you. But
yeah,
they are those.
Put a piece of raw liver around your dog and see what happens. They salivating for it. It's so interesting. No, but you bring up a really good point, and it's something that I think a lot about too. And Harry and I have had this discussion. It's like, if you just survey, right, if you just do like just basic statistics, right? So 70% of the population is overweight or obese. Mm-hmm. 40% of our kids are overweight or obese. Like you were talking about with your wife, I think it's like 80 million Americans are pre-diabetic. There's a huge mm-hmm. percentage that don't even know that they have it.
Right.
And we've never been this fat ever in recorded history.
Right.
Like the data shows that we've clearly changed our food system tremendously within the last 100, actually more so 50 years. Yeah. So it's like, okay, well, clearly what we're doing isn't working. The food that we're eating isn't working. So why would we not experiment and try something different? And I don't know why the average person doesn't think that way. So I guess it's
But I think they are. They're just experimenting with plant-based.
Yes.
You know, like the other day, I think today I saw it. I think Brian Sanders posted it about, was it New York school district, where it was like an article where I said, you know, kids, they're eating too many processed foods and junk foods and blah, blah. So we're now going to try vegan. I'm like, okay, I get the idea that, you know, the processed junk food is not good for kids, but why go from that to vegan? Can you get healthier by cutting out all the processed junk food? Probably, you know, very likely. But that would not be my first choice. But, you know, that's the, I think that's really one of the issues that, you know, people are trying to do things differently. They're just doing it in a very not so smart way, you know, by going all the plant, because everything that is green is good, you know. I think that's really the main issue. Instead of saying, you know what, let's think about, you know, what have humans eaten for most of evolution? Let's try that first, because chances are that's the most compatible food, you know.
Absolutely. And New York City is fascinating too. I put out a Substack post today. Harry and I were talking about it this morning. New York is interesting because Mayor Eric Adams, he's plant-based, he's vegan. So he's actually, New York is a situation where you have a mayor that's pushing his dietary preferences on our children, which is really scary. So in 2021, he introduced Meatless Mondays. And then in February of this year, he introduced plant-based Fridays or something like that. So now our kids are having about 40% of their meals that are plant-based. And when you look at the quality of the food that they're being served, it's like a bag of tortilla chips fried in seed oils, like fruit snacks, a bunch of vegetables that are probably sprayed in glyphosate and heated back up. And the article that you saw today was he started his third thing where they're creating this council of like famous chefs that's like Rachel Ray and a few others. And they're creating 100 plant-based healthy meals that will be rolled out to schools over the coming years. So it's just terrifying, like we were talking about, when you learn about the impact of fat-soluble vitamins and saturated fat to a healthy brain and cognitive development, and realizing that you're like forcibly taking meat away from kids and you're not even giving them the option to choose. You're just saying, no, every Monday and Friday, you can't have meat.
Right, right. I'm glad we took our kids out of school this year. So, you know, at least that part is not an issue anymore. But yeah, it's really, you almost got to do exactly the opposite of you know, of what is considered to be normal, you know, and try to stay away from all of that as much as you can. And fortunately, we are in a position where we have that opportunity and that freedom, you know, letting the kids stay at home and, you know, having our own, you know, homestead and all of those things. But the problem is, most people don't have that luxury, you know, and they have to deal with all of that. And I can see how tiring that is for many to, you know, fight that battle every single day. Everywhere you go, you have to swim upstream and jump through hoops to do the right thing. And I get why many people say, you know what, it's not worth it. Everyone is doing it. Let's just roll with it, because I'm kind of okay. So let's just roll with it. But, you know, it's difficult. It's really, you gotta take certain things into your own hands and really do things differently and be okay with being different, you know. If that leads to you being healthier and happier and having a more fulfilled life, you know.
It's funny you say that, because we were at White Oak Pastures, which we were telling you about before the show, and one of the speakers there talked about just embracing being weird, which I told him afterwards. I was like, you know, that's a message that more people need to hear. Just because I think a lot of social pressures kind of weigh on people, and it limits them to what other people think of them or what they should be doing. And a lot of times what people are suffering from is just a lack of just going out and taking a shot on something for themselves, or doing that thing that they know is like unique to them and weird to them, but it gives them satisfaction. So I think it's a good point. And it was something that I remember writing down and just being like, okay, this is something worth repeating, because it's a message that a lot of people should hear.
No, absolutely. And the funny thing is, you know, if you are different and people see that you're doing well and you're thriving and that you're, you know, killing it in the gym and you look so much so different than anyone else, you know, at your age, then you can actually become a leader in that in your environment by inspiring people to do the same, you know, and to make changes and to be healthier and be better. And we've seen it in our environment so often where, you know, you just inspire people that you wouldn't even have thought you inspired, you know, just by doing what you're doing and showing proof that what you're doing is working, you know, that you you look good, you look healthy, you know, you're killing it. And if others are not, then they might start thinking, okay, what is he doing that I'm not, you know, why is he, you know, so much more energetic? Why, you know, can he perform better? Why is he, you know, having, you know, can do so many things, you know, the homestead, the blogging, you know, the supplements, how is that possible? You know, I could not, you know, and I was asking those some questions when I, you know, so others do things that I'm like, there is no way I could even do that. But, you know, if you have the energy, if you have the mental clarity, if you have, you know, if you have all of those things going on for you, if you just thrive, then suddenly things are possible, you know, and you can do so much more than what you thought, you know, you could.
It's such an amazing point. And it's like, we talk a lot about just our response to when, if we have friends that will say, oh, you know, a carnivore diet is so expensive or an animal diet is so expensive. And we always say, number one, we actually don't think that it's more expensive at all because you're not buying any of the unnecessary crap that's in the internet grocery store. Yeah. And number two, even if it was a few dollars, like say, you know, your grass-fed, grass-finished ground beef is more expensive than the ground beef you're going to get in a grocery store. What is that few extra dollars for quality worth? Like for you, you're saying you have this increased energy, so you're going to play with your kids more, which is a priceless investment. You have time to start to blog and write more articles and quit your 9-to-5 to be able to pursue something you're passionate about, start a supplement company. I mean, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's millions of dollars over the course of years. That's all comes from the energy that you're having because of your food. And you're also changing as a person for the better. We had on Doug Reynolds that founded Low Carb USA. And so he puts on these big conferences every single year. And he said that the attendant at the hotel after one of his event came up to him and said, out of every event that we've ever worked for 30 plus years in business, the people that were at this conference were by far the most friendly out of anyone.
Right.
And I'm like, that's not a coincidence that all the low carb people that are eating raw foods and saturated fat and fueling themselves are the happiest. So I don't know. Yeah. I think you just make a really good point.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, but you might also, you know, have to understand that what you think the price of food is isn't really what the price of food is. You know, if you look at, you know, subsidized, you know, monocrops, you're buying them at a price that is less than, you know, what it takes to make those foods, you know. It's just because the government, you know, subsidizes those things. So if you get used to getting a, you know, a $1, you know, Happy Meal or whatever, that's not the price of real food, you know. And that's also an important, I think, argument to make that, you know, real food costs a certain amount of money. And maybe, you know, you should be investing more money in food than in, you know, a fancy car or in, you know, whatever else, you know, in all of your TV subscriptions, you know. So there is, you know, certainly that aspect as well. But I agree, you know, with what you said. I mean, if you buy especially, you know, ground beef, grass-fed, grass-finished is among the least expensive foods there is. Even if you go to Whole Foods and be fancy, you know, for less than $10, you can get a pound of grass-fed, grass-finished meat. Very often it's less expensive. We go to our farmer's market, we buy it in bulk. If we run out of, you know, we typically buy an entire cow a year, but we eat so much meat that we eat more than that. So we go to the farmer's market and some very often, almost every week, they have like a sale going on for $6.50 a pound from a local farm here in Georgia. It's not White Oak, even though we buy from the last cow actually came from White Oak, but it's another farm here. And I mean, for $6.50, the conventionally grain-fed beef at any other store is not significantly less, you know, and you get top quality meat from a local farm. It doesn't have to be a steak, you know. Meat is meat, you know. At the end of the day, food is predominant, is first and foremost, you know, energy and instructions for your body to operate optimally. Yes, it's got to taste good and all of that, but you don't need to be fancy with a, you know, with a filet or with a ribeye every day. You know, buy less expensive cuts and be healthier and more energetic and happier. That's definitely much better than, you know, spending money on some junk food.
Mm. Michael, would you maybe just to put a little bit of a bow on this conversation, you've mentioned it a few times, the homestead, and you also mentioned homeschooling your children, which is something that we've gotten a little bit more educated on ourselves, and just that whole lifestyle is very unique. It's obviously a very intentional action and speaks a lot about like what you stand for, but I think it's a really empowering decision. What sort of got you to that point, or like what made you want to really start to invest your time and energy in that lifestyle? Because it's definitely different, but it's really cool.
Right. I think ultimately it's trying to go back as close as possible to how our ancestors would have lived. Mm. You know, I don't mean by that I have to run in a loincloth all day. But you know, being able to raise your own animals, having full control over the life cycle, not being dependent on, you know, on a grocery store or, you know, what have you, just experiencing what it means to grow food. That was really one of the drivers. And because ultimately our dream is to, you know, to make all of our food, to have, you know, cows and everything that we need to feed the family. That's the ultimate goal. And we just started, you know, with chickens and with honeybees to get our feet wet, you know, and how everything works and what it really means to raise livestock. And then with the kids, it was just, you know, we just don't agree with, you know, the education much as we don't agree with, you know, food advice from governments. And so we wanted to give our kids the opportunity to be kids, to learn on their own pace with, you know, to learn what they want to learn rather than what, you know, the government thinks they should learn. Also because, you know, thinking back, I mean, I had 4 years of French in school and I had, you know, I don't know how many things that I remember nothing because I wasn't interested. I mean, maybe, yeah, now I kind of wish I spoke French too. But at the time, I didn't care. It was a waste of time for me. I would have rather, you know, spent more time in, you know, in front of a computer to learn how to program or, you know, do other things. But that wasn't, you know, possible because it was, everything was structured. And so we said, you know what, we're going to take our kids out, and we actually don't home. Well, it's a form of homeschooling called unschooling, which means there is no curriculum. We don't sit down with them. We are not the teachers in per se, where we, you know, have like from 8 to 12, we have, you know, ABC, math and writing and reading. They do their own thing and we support them, you know, and it's a very radical kind of, it's almost like a carnivore diet of education. but I think it's, you know, how kids learn every human learns by default. I mean, unless you impede their learning, you know, humans learn, they always want to learn. And that's particularly true for kids who have not been, you know, have not gone through the system of, you know, force feeding them stuff and making them not interested in learning. And so just seeing them, how they learn, and that, you know, that's so different to our traditional educational system is just, I think that's, you know, that's the way to go. They should be kids. They should learn at their own pace and whatever they want to learn. And we support them, you know, in doing so. And that gives them also the opportunity to experience what it means to raise, you know, our own food, what it means then, you know, starting next year when we're going to have meat rabbits, what it means to kill an animal, you know. Mm. None of us have done that, at least not, you know, any bigger animal. He might have stepped on an ant, but, you know, killing a rabbit and then skinning the rabbit and processing it and eating that meat is a whole different ballgame. And I think generally society is so removed from such basic things as, you know, processing food, killing an animal, you know, eating it, being grateful for that meat that you have harvested and all of those things. And so it's really going back to, you know, back to the old days and allowing our kids to experience it and allowing us to experience that. I think it's going to make everything so much easier and less stressful. It's a disconnect from modern life in a sense.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing just to see the perspective that your kids have as they grow up, being exposed to some of these things that 99% of kids just do not have access to. So I'm sure that's very exciting for you.
Yep.
Get them in the ice bath and the sauna early.
They've done both. They are not fan of either. You know, I think there is still a component of wanting to feel comfortable. So that's really one of the things where I struggle a little bit, because I firmly believe that, you know, we need to be uncomfortable. And unfortunately, you know, with our modern lives, with, you know, with an AC and, you know, you can be very comfortable, but you shouldn't be. And it's really an uphill battle again to get out of your comfort zone. Whereas if you just lived in the woods, you know, you would be uncomfortable by default, you know. Right. We have to make an effort to make our kids uncomfortable, to make ourselves uncomfortable. I guess that's just part of, you know, living in the modern world.
Absolutely. Michael, what's the best way for people to connect with you if they want to learn a little bit more about what you got going on?
Probably the blog, michaelcoomer.com. I'm also somewhat active on Instagram at mcoomer82. And I have a YouTube channel that I don't publish quite as much on YouTube as I do on my blog and on Instagram, but those are probably the three channels where you can find me, especially if you want to see what's going on you know, on the homestead and some of the stuff that we try out here and experiment with.
Awesome. I love it. That's great. Well, this has been an awesome conversation, man. We really appreciate you coming on and just appreciate you sharing the message and all the good work that you do.
Absolutely. I'm very thankful that you guys gave me the opportunity. Thanks so much.
See you, Michael.
All right. See ya.